Welcome to The Riff, where writer and investor Bern Hobart and I discuss the major inflection points caused by technological change. Our weekly conversation covers the obvious and not so obvious ways in which markets and businesses will adapt as a result. Let's jump right in.
So Bern, in our last episode, we got into a little bit of this idea that inspired one of your posts, is Alpha for Sale. Any follow-up reactions to that since our episode?
Yeah, so one of the things I thought about with that question of is Alpha for Sale is that if you think of just the math of hedge fund compensation, so let's take like a classic hedge fund, they're paid 2% of assets under management, 20% of profits, and the 2% of assets is supposed to cover their costs. And really, really both of those numbers are mostly too high right now, but for the largest funds that are growing their assets the fastest, both of those numbers are probably too low. But anyway, let's say 2 and 20. Okay, so in any given year, if there's like a total P&L of whatever it is, however many million dollars, then 80% of that P&L goes to the limited partners, 20% goes to the general partner, and general partners do tend to reinvest a substantial amount of that. And so what that means is that if the general partner has a stake in the fund, that stake compounds faster because it doesn't have that 20% overhead. And then they get the additional 20% of everyone else's gains. So over time, it's just necessarily true that the general partner ends up controlling more of the fund. And then one of the limits on that is just at some point your fund reaches a size where its strategies no longer work. And some funds have been able to adapt and they choose new strategies. You know, a lot of the funds that we look at today that are doing just a lot of different things, they started out doing one thing and doing it really well. Convertible bond arbitrage is a kind of weird case because it was the original thing that I believe that Citadel was doing actually before it was called Citadel. It was just Ken Griffin running money for people. He was doing convertible bond arbitrage. And then Elliott Associates, which is now the huge activist fund, they also started out doing convertible bond arbitrage. So it is a strategy. It does have some capacity limitations. It gets more competitive over time. And so the biggest and best funds are the ones that have diversified away from just whatever their one initial moneymaker was. But over time, it is just true that the general partner's wealth compounds faster than everybody else's. And at some point, when the fund is hitting capacity constraints, there is this there's a business question to ask, which is, do you want to grow your assets under management past the point at which you can provide superior returns and know that you will be getting lots of management fees and that the management fees are more than enough to cover your costs, so they become a profit center for you? And they're a lot more predictable than those performance fees. You know, you don't have to make money to collect a management fee, although eventually if you don't make any money, your assets all go away. But it is more predictable. It would get a higher multiple in the market. And so that is one strategy that people take, is that they're no longer running an amazing fund. They're just running a big fund that is good enough and can keep gathering assets, and they have a reputation. And, you know, every year their lifetime compounded returns tick down a little bit, but their name recognition ticks up a little bit. And so for a while, those two can kind of balance out, and someone can be managing more than they've ever managed 5 years after they last put up really good returns. But the other option is you say, no, I'm actually really interested in getting high returns. I don't really like doing boring strategies. I don't want to be a salesperson who used to be an investor and now just goes to meetings. I want to do something else. So the way to handle that is you decide, okay, whose capital gets to stay in the fund and whose capital has to leave. And usually, if the person making this decision is the general partner, their capital gets treated a bit better than limited partners. So you have cases like the Medallion Fund, where they were, I believe their performance fee was 44% and their management fee, I think, was 5% or something. And at this point, no one is really, I don't know that anyone is in any economically meaningful sense paying that, because it's all either internal money or like maybe someone is, for sentimental reasons, allowed to keep their external money in there. But it is very much like an extremely generous favor from, you know, your very richest friend. So that's one version of how that can go. Another version, kind of a darker version, is what happened with long-term capital management, where at one point, I don't remember if this was 1997 or 1998, but at one point they realized that all of their strategies, like, they were scalable in an absolute sense. So LTCM was deploying like $100 billion in total, had like $100 billion on its balance sheet, had much, much more than that if you counted the notional exposure of all the derivatives. And they were supporting this with, I think, under $10 billion in capital. But they did realize that at some point, either their returns on capital have to go down or they have to cap the size of their fund. And so they capped the size of the fund. They actually kicked limited partners out, forced them to take back some of their capital. The general partners of the fund put in more capital, and then the whole thing blew up. So one kind of ironic result of that was that actually the limited partners who invested in the beginning and were forced to take some of their money out, they actually got pretty decent returns. I don't think they beat the S&P 500, but that was never supposed to be LTCM's benchmark. They got good returns because the fund had good strategies for a while, had some deficiencies in risk management that were really only apparent when it was already collapsing. And also the principals of the fund happened to have bad market timing where they looked at how their strategy was getting more crowded. There are more people making these trades. There's just less room to deploy lots of capital. And they said, okay, we're going to keep more of these scarce opportunities for ourselves. Turned out to be the wrong call, but it's a very understandable call because at some point, if you are an investor, you have a really good track record, you are able to multiply people's money, you start asking, like, why am I doing this? And one way to think about the capital from limited partners is that it's actually very expensive capital. So if you are, for example, Renaissance, and your returns are still in the 30s after all those fees, it actually implies that your cost of capital is 30-something percent for LP money, and your cost of capital is going to be much, much lower if you are borrowing that money from your prime broker or just otherwise trying to fund it through something other than equity capital. So basically, the better an investor is, the more expensive it is for them to take equity capital. This is kind of analogous to how with startups, like, if you start a startup and it's growing really fast and it generates free cash flow and it actually generates enough cash that there's not an immediately obvious place to put the last dollar you earn in a given year, then you really don't need to raise money. And if you do raise money, it's going to be on pretty generous terms. And it's probably like this was the case with Microsoft, where they were extremely conservative financially, as much as they could be, because they did have some scary moments early on where they had some customer concentration. The customers they were concentrated with were not the best customers. So things got pretty dicey for a while. So they basically decided we're just going to keep a lot of cash on hand. And because there just weren't that many companies trying to hire talented programmers in the 1970s, they were still able to grow at a fast pace. And the market they were selling into was also growing fast. So when they raised outside money, it was basically a way to, one, make it more legitimate when they went public, that it wouldn't be like this company no one's ever heard of, maybe it's a scam. Like obviously people had heard of it, but like you didn't really know for sure. But if it had the endorsement from a venture capitalist who'd owned shares of the company for a while and could say it was good, then it was just easier to take public. And there was also some internal maneuvering. So there's this interview with actually with the VC who invested in them, where he suggests that a big driver of Microsoft's decision to raise external capital was that Steve Ballmer had been promised equity, but it was a verbal promise, and he was having a lot of trouble getting an actual contract from Bill Gates that said, this is how much equity you get. And as the value of that hypothetical equity got higher and higher, it became really, really important to him that there actually be some piece of paper somewhere that a lawyer had looked at least once that did actually say that he owned as much of it as he wanted to, or it had been promised. And so he wanted that. And then, of course, it's, kind of, I think for late stage diligence, it's like useful to make sure that you know who has equity and how much they have. So at that point, you do actually have to have a contract. So like, you can have these cases where companies don't need to raise any money, but in some cases, they still do. But it's a very different kind of raise from the company where they are burning cash, but you can tell they're producing a lot of value. And it's just a question of, do they want to grow like 20% a year without external funding, or like 100% a year because they can raise equity and use that to grow faster. So I think it's a useful framework to have in mind that over time, if you find someone you can invest in and they can actually produce predictably good returns, it is temporary, that either those returns will get less good or your ability to invest in them will diminish. So that does mean like alpha gets sold all the time. Like people are constantly pitching products on the basis of this gets you exposure to some market, but better returns than you would get from just generic exposure to that market. And those pitches, like they can't all be true on average because alpha has to sum to zero across all market participants, but they can be true in specific cases. It's just, you should always look at it as this temporary thing of either someone has temporarily found an opportunity to exploit some market phenomenon, and I want to capitalize them to do that for as long as it's a viable business model, or I have actually found an opportunity to exploit someone and get better returns than I really deserve for just making a passive investment I don't have to actively manage. But I know that they know also that it's not like I worked especially hard to put this check into this particular company. So it's, you know, over time, fees will go up or returns will go down, or the limited partners will be first out the door when the business runs into capital constraints.
Yeah, it's interesting. I just think about that as it relates to venture. You know, some firms like A16Z and Sequoia and Founders Fund and Thrive, once their early funds have crushed it, they scaled significantly, and presumably their multiples, while still great, you know, aren't as good as their smaller funds. Whereas other firms like USV or First Round have also crushed it, but decided to stay the same size, which maybe, you know, contributed to their multiples being higher, but they probably didn't make more money overall than the other people. And their, you know, and there were LPs who got squeezed out or wish they could have invested, who didn't. Though, of course, the LPs who did invest are probably happier, at least on a multiples basis, unless they wanted to invest a whole lot more and would have taken a lower multiple.
Yeah, that's my understanding, is that there is often LP pressure, like, there, and like, it kind of has to be the case that if different investment managers have different preferences here, and some of them want to gather lots of assets and some of them want to just continue doing what they're doing, they like it, and they like that every time, you know, a big endowment fund publishes enough performance numbers that you can see individual companies' performance, like I think it's the University of Texas investment management company that does publish pretty regularly just what the returns were from different investments, so you can actually see which fund did what. I think they probably find it pretty appealing that they will be on the top of the percentage gains list, even if they are in the middle of the pack in terms of dollars added. So you'll have LP pressure telling them, like, please just raise a larger fund. Like, it doesn't have to be a growth fund. It doesn't have to be like the, you know, the $10 billion USV follow-on fund, but like, please raise a larger fund so we can put more money with you because we like how you work. And then for the funds that do try to expand, there's presumably like some pressure in the other direction of like, do you guys really think that the next $1 billion that you get is going to produce as many good opportunities as the first billion that you ever raised? And the realistic answer is no, but you can sometimes, like, there are some elements of the business that can be scalable. Deal sourcing is, you know, it's very, very tied to just where is this particular partner or whoever, where are they in the network of potential founders, and how close are they to the founders who you'd really want to get involved in? And so sometimes, like, gathering partners who are central nodes in networks that your fund is not otherwise participating in can be a way to actually scale that pretty linearly. And then on the data and information gathering side, there are some economies of scale. Y Combinator has shown that there are some economies of scale in terms of when you have a cohort of startups that all know each other, they can all sell to each other. So you've got some ARR that's circulating through the YC community, but you also have some very picky people who are going to use somebody else's SaaS product that's not something they could build on their own. And so it does actually provide some useful validation of those companies that they can sell, even if they're selling mostly to other YC firms. It at least, like, that means more than selling to some other incubator or selling to the same number of companies, but they're all, I don't know, plumbing businesses in Iowa or something. Like, the, you know, it could be the same ARR, but it should actually get a different multiple depending on where it comes from. So you got some arguments for economies of scale, and you can think of the crossover funds as a way to get economies of scale on more on data gathering in a more systematic way, where if they are buying lots of data, like lots of web scraping data in order to track public companies, and they're buying the credit card data, and they are, you know, using, like, looking at traffic and looking at which apps are growing and which apps are shrinking. Like, they do have opportunities to say, not just we're going to short this company because a startup is eating their lunch, but we're going to buy shares of this startup because it's eating the incumbent's lunch. So they're like, there, you can sort of gesture towards economies of scale, but I think in practice it is just extremely rare for anyone to scale up capital and scale up returns and do both on a sustainable basis. And the examples of that happening are pretty illuminating. So one case where someone was actually able to ramp up assets under management and get massively higher returns was John Paulson when he was shorting mortgage-backed securities. But that was raising a special purpose vehicle to do one trade, to do it extremely in extreme size, and he did also have phenomenal timing. I think if like a lot of the arguments that he was making for why housing is a bubble, why this is all going to fall apart, like you could make most of those arguments a couple of years beforehand, and he could have ended up raising a smaller fund because it was a different financial environment and not making nearly as much money and perhaps closing that fund down before it all worked out. Like Paulson did actually do a good job of figuring out what you would measure to time this correctly. And he figured out the timing was right. Like this was the time to do it, but yeah, it's also his returns since then have just not been great. So, so clearly it's really hard to do. It's really hard to scale those businesses and scale them in a systematic way. You can think of the multi-strategy funds as having maybe figured out the right way to scale things, but it's always really hard to declare the end of history when you have this new-ish model, and it's grown really fast and it's levered up significantly. And we just don't really know what that looks like under certain market circumstances. And we can say, like, it's pretty hard to think of a more extreme environment than March of 2020. And those funds did fine. Like, I don't know of any big multi-strategy fund that blew up during the COVID crisis. In fact, a lot of people, those funds were getting worried about COVID pretty early. So they were probably positioned pretty well. And certainly if they're buying lots of data sets, they would have been among the first to see that, okay, it's, you know, it looked like the world was ending, but actually it is just the greatest shopping spree for sporting goods, equipment, furniture, home remodeling, et cetera, that the world has ever seen. Not to mention the largest commercial real estate build out in history was when every white collar worker started working from home. They all needed nice chairs, you know, better computer peripherals, probably a faster computer, and all that stuff had to get bought, and it showed up in the data, and some funds made a killing on it. So yeah, though, like maybe they have actually figured out what is the model for making this work sustainably, but I think it is probably the wrong time to definitively say so.
Hey everybody, Eric here with a word from our sponsors. Hey everyone, Eric here. At Turpentine, we're building the first media outlet for tech people by tech people. We're the network behind the show you're listening to right now. We have a slate of hit shows across a range of topics and industries, from our AI and investing cluster of podcasts to shows that drive the conversation in tech with the most interesting thinkers, founders, investors, and influencers, like Econ 102 with Noah Smith. We're launching new shows every week, and we're looking for industry-leading sponsors. If you think that might be you and your company, email me at ericaturpentine.co. That's E-R-I-K at turpentine.co, and let's partner together. The tech world turns to the Brave browser for its unbeatable privacy protections. But did you know that Brave also has a private ad platform? Brave Ads offers first-party targeting, and it's been cookie-less since day one, so you can relax while third-party tracking cookies disappear from the web. Today, millions of people turn to ad blockers to avoid being tracked and pestered online. But Brave's new ad model aligns incentives for users and advertisers. Users earn rewards for viewing ads, which they can save, spend, or pass along to their favorite creators. And advertisers score points for respecting user privacy, generating ROI without invasive tracking. So whether it's high-impact announcements on the new tab page or keyword-targeted ads in Brave Search, Brave offers diverse, private, future-proof ad formats for all your business goals. Join the future of advertising at brave.com/ads. Mention MOZ when signing up for a 25% discount on your first campaign.
Let's segue into talking about multi-manager hedge funds, and then we'll get into sort of hedging. You wrote a separate post about that more broadly, but let's talk about multi-manager hedge funds first.
Yeah, sure. So there was this interesting story a couple days ago about one of those funds trying to scale up its headcount. And one of the things that occurred to me in reading about that was that the traditional reason that asset management economics are so good is that you basically have no costs. Like if you have, I guess the classic model is like if you have a desk and a phone, and then the more modern model is if you have a desk, a phone, and an internet connection, and maybe a Bloomberg terminal, like you can be a hedge fund. And your costs just do not scale up very much. Like you could theoretically be running billions of dollars on that basis. You probably need some back office people at that point. They're just not that expensive when your management fees are $10 million a year plus. But the multi-manager approach, where you have a bunch of people pursuing different strategies, you are deliberately designing every strategy to be as uncorrelated as possible, and you're building all the infrastructure to measure that and to trade it efficiently and to make sure that you're getting a low-cost borrow on the stocks you're shorting, et cetera, like all of that has a fixed cost. And so you could actually reach the point where you invert the pathology of the old model. So the old model, one of the problems was you can have a general partner where their mandate is, you know, perform, like, you know, have performance in line with the S&P 500, but half the volatility. Like, that was a plausible thing to tell people you were targeting in the 90s. But if you ended up with, you've got half the market's returns and half the volatility, but you have a really good story and your pitches always sound incredible, it's possible you end up with a lot of assets under management and you're just not doing a lot to deserve that. So you're making money, but your investors would have done better just with an index fund. But now we can actually get the inversion of that, which is the funds do produce uncorrelated alpha and they produce a lot of it, but to make it a viable product for investors to buy, they have to give everyone such a big break on fees that they're actually eating a lot of those startup costs themselves. So maybe if it might have been the case that, like, 10 years ago, if you had 10 different uncorrelated strategies, you had enough, you had the ingredients for a successful fund, you could raise money, you could, like, people would be happy with that pitch. And then as you grew, you'd add more strategies and your risk adjusted returns would keep getting better and you would be able to charge more fees on that. But maybe now the cutoff is like 40 or 50 strategies, or maybe the cutoff is like everyone you can hire out of some other fund is someone that other fund was not especially sad to see leave. And so you can end up with like 50 people who are objectively really good at what they do, but are not able to actually produce enough returns to pay for all the fixed costs involved in hiring them. So we may end up seeing some multi-manager funds where results are okay for investors, but the fund itself actually loses money and has to shut down for that reason. And I think that'll be fun. It'll be a nice little inversion of the usual way things work. It will be interesting to see how it fits into a kind of class war inequality framework. If it's like pension funds and college endowments are ruthlessly exploiting these poor billionaires who unfortunately have to burn, you know, 5 or 10% of their fortune every year just to keep the lights on, and they're all just hoping for a lucky break and hoping to find the magic set of strategies that allows them to produce 15% net returns after all those costs and still have some money to take home for themselves. I don't know that we'll actually get that far, because the people running these funds tend to be reasonably savvy at business and are reasonably likely to just pencil out the numbers and shut things down if it's not working well. But we could see that happen.
You wrote a separate blog post about hedging, just and thinking about sort of that framework to other things in life. Why don't you unpack what you're trying to do there?
Yeah. So I've always been fascinated with this idea that we do have financial risks. Like, we face these random risks that financial theory tells you should probably hedge if there's a cost-effective hedge. So if you drive a car and your car has a gas tank, you are exposed to fluctuations in the price of gasoline, and those fluctuations, you know, depending on how much money you have saved, and you know whether you are a high earner who's putting away a lot of money every year, or someone living paycheck to paycheck, like, those fluctuations in gas prices can have a very meaningful impact on your life. And there are assets that you can use to hedge that. So there are companies that will buy lots of land that has oil and gas resources and then do just a rev share for whoever is exploring on that. And then they pay out that income as a dividend to shareholders. So in theory, you could find one of those royalty trusts and pick one that's paying out a dividend of, say, 10%, which, like, the higher yielding ones do pay out a 10% dividend. The variance in dividends between royalty trusts indicates that there are just different operating assumptions that people have on how long that will last. But let's imagine it's 10%. Okay, so you could figure out, here's how much you pay every year for gas, and that buying enough of a royalty trust that you can actually offset that income is basically you take that annual expense and divide it by 10%. So multiply it by 10. So you get 20K. So for 20K, you could buy enough shares of a royalty trust that on average, if gas prices doubled, your dividends would roughly double, and then you'd be fine. You would be unaffected by that fluctuation. And then the problem with that is, of course, anyone for whom a doubling of the cost of filling their gas tank is actually like an economic catastrophe, they don't have $20,000. They don't actually have the money available to put on this hedge, there are more capital efficient hedges. So you could try buying oil futures instead, but the minimum increment for that is the futures contract represents 1,000 barrels. So you're trading on a lot of oil. It's closer to hedging your lifetime exposure than your week-to-week exposure. And it also has a lot of leverage. And that is another issue with personal hedging, is that you're basically thinking of your expenses as one leg of a trade, and you're hedging that somewhere else. So you're saying, if you drive a car and it uses gas, you have a short position in gas, and you can hedge that. But the problem is, your short position is not marked to market, but your long position offsetting it is marked to market. So you can have a case where you are hedging this, you're using a lot of leverage, the cost of filling up a tank drops by half, and so your oil liability has dropped by half, and your oil asset has dropped by half. But you get a margin call on the oil asset. You don't get a margin, you can't tell your broker that I'm good for this. You should allow my account to have significant negative equity because I'm also spending less on gas. Like they don't care. And this actually happened with nickel, when the nickel market actually shut down and had decided to unwind a bunch of trades. It was because there was a major nickel miner who had large hedging trades. The hedging trades lost money. He was technically good for it, like he had it, because the nickel he owned was worth a lot more, but he couldn't really use that as collateral. And he had a significant enough amount of negative equity that it could have really messed with the metals market if it became clear that these contracts had an insolvent counterparty. So that is a case study in how this can go very wrong. And then I think the last things to think about are, one, just the global portfolio does require some people to warehouse some kinds of risk. Like, the risks don't go away, they get shifted around. And anytime you have, let's say there's an investor who used to be 100% net long stocks, like they're a stock picker and they're just choosing which stocks to buy. And they decide, okay, that's too risky, and it's unclear how much I'm getting paid for being a good stock picker and how much I'm getting paid for happening to have equity portfolio manager on my business card in a year when the S&P did really well. Like, I'm getting paid for some combination of those things, but I'd rather get paid for the thing I think I'm actually good at. So they switch from 100% long to long short. Well, to do that, they have to sell shares in equivalent. They have to do net selling that is equivalent to whatever assets they manage, which means somebody else has to do net buying equivalent to that amount. So the net long exposure still exists somewhere. Maybe it's shifted from an active manager to an index fund, but it hasn't gone away. And so we have to think about, okay, which economic entities are actually best equipped to handle this risk? And I think for equities, it is actually probably true that households are better equipped to handle the risk of equity fluctuations, specifically like middle-class households that can save some money and are saving in order to have a better retirement than they otherwise have, but not like saving because they will otherwise be destitute. I think for those families, it's not pleasant for them to lose half of their retirement savings in a market drawdown. But if those are retirement savings they weren't planning to touch for 20 years, and they know that on average the market does fine over long periods, then it's more to dollar cost average into, and it won't lead to any kind of domino effect where they're forced to sell, so someone else is forced to sell, so you get a spiraling crisis. So I think it's actually kind of okay for a lot of people to be holding some of these risks themselves, especially because actually thinking about the risks and actually trying to manage them is so difficult. And it really only pays off at the point where the risk to you of this asset price fluctuation is just not going to be that material. Like, you'll be fine. You'll be fine either way if you are sophisticated enough and wealthy enough to actually go ahead and hedge it. And then the other thing is that in some fields, we basically require people to take this equity-like risk just as the cost of participating. So in venture, you're traditionally supposed to put some of the capital from the fund. Like, most of the capital is outside investors. Some of it is from you. And from an asset allocation standpoint, that's actually just a really bad deal. Like, you should be diversifying away from this fund because it also pays for your income. Like, it is your income. And if you double down on that and add more capital to it, you're radically increasing your risk. But of course, your investors actually like that. Like, they like the fact that if you do a bad job investing this fund, not only will you lose your job because you won't be able to raise another fund, but you will also lose some of the money you put into the fund in the first place. So it is this test of, it is like a lot of other signaling games, like it is a test of, are you willing to do something that is on one level irrational in order to signal your commitment to something else that is otherwise hard to credibly signal? So maybe we should, in the end, kind of embrace it and say that there is, like, it is a necessity that not all risks be hedged by all market participants, because then there's no one to hedge with. And also that sometimes being irrationally risk seeking on paper is just the price for a shot at greatness.
Yeah,
and actually, we can loop that back to the multi-strategy discussion, because it is like this objectively really high risk thing to do, to say, I'm going to hire some of the most expensive people on earth into a business that does not actually make money right now, because I strongly believe that if I just hire enough extremely expensive people, I will eventually reach a critical mass where it is actually economically viable. So that is, yeah, it's another case where they're really doubling down on risk. Like, from a risk adjusted perspective, it is probably much, much smarter to try to become a limited partner in Citadel or Millennium or someone like that, rather than to try to start the next Citadel or Millennium. But the fact that that is true, and the fact that a stylized version of that was true, you know, 40 years ago, is also why the people who started those funds are worth so much money, is that they did the kind of crazy risk seeking thing and it worked really well. But that can only be true in the aggregate if most of the people who do that risk seeking thing end up regretting it.
Yeah. Well said. Let's segue to your post on outage economics when you talk about that.
Yeah, so I've been thinking a lot about software bugs recently. I had a piece not too long ago about the launch of Antithesis, which is a company that I've been following for a long time. Work with them with Diff Jobs, and it's a really interesting company that uses software to model the performance of other complex software projects, and in particular, trying to find edge cases that are the interaction of a bunch of different hardware issues, or of like, there's a hardware problem that leads to a bug in this part of the software, but that bug actually doesn't cause any problems here. It actually causes problems when its output gets parsed by this thing over here. And then that, you know, there's like all these cascading weird things where if you're just treating them as independent probabilities, you will actually never stumble on whatever scenario causes the bug. So you have to have some level of sophistication in where you basically try to model the entire system and figure out what are the most informative states of the system, like what are the states that are most likely to lead to an interesting outcome, and then you apply brute force. Which in the post I compare this to Napoleon, where his kind of standard thing was he is generally outnumbered like 2-to-1 everywhere except where people are shooting at each other, and there he outnumbers the other side by 2-to-1, and so he's always like statistically coming up for a big defeat, and then in any practical case, he can still apply brute force where it actually matters. But the reason this came up again was that there were a couple high-profile outages. So AT&T's network was down for a while, not for me, or at least I didn't miss any calls at 3 a.m. that day. And then Coinbase was down. Well, Coinbase had some issues for a while where, for whatever reason, the way that they seem to have set up the account balance feature was that it tries to load your balance. If it can't find the balance, like if whatever service that gives it that number doesn't return anything, it just defaults to zero. Zero is just not a good number to show people in their financial statements, especially if it's not true. So that that annoyed some people. And what it brought up for me was that if you think about trying to build a system like Coinbase or, you know, the AT&T wireless network, like one, extremely daunting. Like it is extremely hard to do that even badly. And it's extremely hard to enumerate all of the ways that it's a difficult thing to do. So like it's impressive that anyone tries. It's impressive that these things mostly work and mostly work extremely well. And so it's instructive to think about why they might fail. And one reason is that if you take some system where no one has given any thought to reliability and you start asking, well, what can go wrong? You end up making a bunch of very simple, straightforward judgments based on knowable properties of individual components. So you can say things like, hard drives have a certain failure rate over time, and if our architecture implicitly assumes no hard drive ever fails, then there will be constant failures. We can actually predict how often those failures happen. And once we can predict that, then we can say, okay, if you add a buffer of some number of hard drives, then statistically, the failure rate can asymptotically approach zero. Like you have enough backups that when something fails, as long as the failures are truly uncorrelated, there's always a backup for it. And you always have enough lead time to, you know, provision more hardware, get things steady. So, okay, you solve that problem. And then you can look at other problems of like drop packets or, you know, any kind of way that messages can get mangled. And you can start enumerating those possibilities and thinking about how do you check a message that went from subsystem A to subsystem B and make sure that subsystem B got the right message. How do you make sure that if there's actually a whole series of messages, so, you know, maybe you've got something from the trade confirmation engine and also something from the back office engine that is just tracking account values and something else from, I don't know, customer service about whether or not some asset is flagged or frozen or whatever. You want to make sure that the messages are either all arriving in the right order, or since that's actually not strictly possible, at least that your system knows that there is some ordering of messages and that sometimes it needs to wait, it needs to query something and make sure that it's not waiting for another message, et cetera. So like initially, a lot of these are pretty straightforward multiplications of different uncorrelated probabilities. So different independently distributed failure modes. And then once you've gotten rid of all of those, your next category of mistakes is just harder to model. So like it's pretty straightforward to get numbers on things like how often does an SSD fail? Or something like if we actually have a server in a closet, what percent of the time is the power out or the internet out or something else going to cause this server to not exist as far as the network is concerned? But answering a question like what percentage of functions in a given program have bugs or conditional on there being a bug that doesn't show up every time that a function is run, how often does it show up and under what circumstances? Like now you're looking at something a little more uncertain. You are looking at something where basically if you can identify the category of problem, you can fix it, which means the problems that exist are the ones you haven't thought of yet. They're unknown unknowns. So you quickly reach this much, much less friendly distribution of outcomes. And then you start to have to ask these broader strategic questions of like, if there is really no limit to how much money Amazon could invest in making sure that S3 always works, what is the point at which they stop spending the incremental dollar? And what is the point at which they say there is an acceptable failure rate and it's not zero, but it's a pretty small number? And you can actually see companies kind of slot into different categories there. So some companies will just try to be more reliable than anyone else. Some companies will, like their whole pitch is we have some new approach that just allows us to have a different efficient frontier for reliability. Unfortunately, the company that comes to mind for that is actually FTX, because they did have a really clever idea for how they would handle margin, where they would basically continuously liquidate people's portfolios as both the performance of like both price changes and their volatility increase the probability that someone's account would go negative. And that like the traditional way that crypto exchanges would handle this is if someone's account goes negative, everyone else eats the cost, which means if you are really like the more right you are, the more you get this immediate windfall profits tax so that the exchange can survive, because the money's not coming from your counterparty because your counterparty lost 400% on their levered Pepe futures trade. So the money's coming from the exchange, but the exchange doesn't have that much money either. It also doesn't feel like paying you. So the money comes out of other customers. So the FTX approach was, in theory, a clever way to handle this, where you just smoothly, continuously liquidate things. But in practice, they just didn't do that, or it didn't actually work the way they thought it did, because there were cases where people found exploits where they could arbitrarily jack up the price of some very liquid crypto token and then take out a large loan against that appreciated crypto token, which was also handled algorithmically, and then just move that loan off of their FTX account, wire it somewhere else, and then leave. And then in that case, FTX customers actually ate the loss, which they found out about many months later. But so that is another approach where you actually basically build your product on having some different approach to reliability. And then yet another approach is you say, we're actually not going to compete on reliability. We are going to compete on cost. And reliability is our lever for specifically getting rid of certain costs. And we know that customers are going to periodically hate us, but they will also keep coming back because it's so cheap. So companies like Temu, Shein, Wish, etc., when they do slow and variable shipping, that is sort of what they're doing. They're basically saying, we are going to skip the entire effort to build this giant low latency shipping system that could get anything to your door in 1 to 2 days. Instead, we're going to get something to your door in, you know, 7 to 21 days, and it will probably be what you ordered, but not necessarily what you ordered. And whoever sold it to us may or may not still be in business by the time you actually get the product and by the time we get the customer complaint, but it will be really cheap. It will be, you know, $5 tops, whatever it is. So that is another approach that you can use. Some companies will actually they will build fully redundant systems. So as I was looking into this, I learned that planes, I don't know if this is still standard, but at one point the standard was you have 3 navigation systems and they are all continuously producing results. And anytime they disagree, it's just a majority vote. So what's the science fiction dystopia that this is a riff on? Minority Report. So it's like a Minority Report approach to not having your plane crash into a mountain. Generally works. Another approach is you give multiple teams of programmers the same spec and then ask them to write a product. And then you make sure, then you run tests on it and you either throw out the one that doesn't produce the same results as everyone else's, or you look for the product that has like weird latency issues or some other source of uncertainty and throw that out. So these are all really expensive. Like developing one, like doing one software project is expensive. Doing the same software project 4 times with 4 different teams that by design cannot learn anything from each other, because any information leakage could mean that bugs are leaking from one team to another. That's even more expensive. So it's costly. There is a nonlinear cost to doing all of this stuff. But for some products, it matters enough to customers and it is the focus of their diligence such that you basically have to do it. Like exchanges are an example of this. They often have a complete duplicate of their data center in some other data center, so that if someone accidentally flips the wrong switch in the main data center, or there's like a meteorite or whatever, New York Stock Exchange still opens at 9:30 Eastern. That also does not always work. So there was actually a New York Stock Exchange outage that was caused by, I think what happened was they had a backup location and they ran a test, which they should do. They ran a test to make sure that the backup worked just like the real thing. But then they actually forgot to flip the switch to turn off the test. And so you had, I think, two identical copies of the New York Stock Exchange, both trying to run at the same time. So yeah, lots of errors there. And they were not able to launch. Yeah. And this also happened, a very similar story in Japan. So even when you add these backups, like you are still in this realm of probabilities that are impossible to estimate. And you're also in the realm of, it's not just technological failures. It's not just a hardware problem or a software problem. It's an institutional problem. It's a people problem. Like at some point, you know, if you're going to run a test, there has to be someone running that test. That person has to have cleanup procedures after the test. And so you're still counting on a person to follow a checklist. And then, you know, we're back to redundancy always helps. So if instead of having one person run the test, you have 5 people run the test and then another 5 people each check the previous person's checklist to make sure that they did all of the startup things right and all of the shutdown things right. And then you make sure the tests produced either identical results or produce the right level of variance between one another, depending on how deterministic your testing is, then you can avoid, you can mitigate part of that problem, but you've also added some overhead. So I think there's just like, there is this invisible layer of expenses at every major company that runs any kind of complicated semi-distributed system. And I think in practice, like pretty much every software system we use is in some sense distributed, unless it is literally some piece of embedded, like unless it's like embedded, you know, firmware, and it's just interacting with the signals it gets from sensors on whatever machine it's attached to. Like, if it's not that, it's probably using external APIs or someone's accessing it from a browser. It's always this interaction between multiple machines. So everything pretty much in practice is a distributed system, which means everything has these non-deterministic bugs. And it's nice to know that things mostly work. Like we're chatting on Riverside. Riverside is working. I don't ask myself, what's our contingency plan if Riverside is down? And, you know, what if Zoom doesn't work because the actual problem is an internet outage or a power outage or whatever? Like, I generally just assume that these things work. But I know that for that to be the case, there have to be lots of people working nights and weekends so that other people are not working nights and weekends to clean up after the mess.
Yeah. That's a good overview. I want to transition to your piece on search engines or search having feedback loops where the search engine accumulates more data and how that applies to AI.
Yeah. So I think this is part of my argument that search is just the best business anyone has ever created. Like, it's an ad business where you literally ask customers, please tell me what products you would like to see ads for, and I will show you ads. And then you tell your advertisers, hey, we have this magical mind reading machine. We can literally tell you who wants to buy the thing you sell right now. How much would you pay to be the first person to offer that thing to that person? And it's usually a lot. But it's not just a really good monetization model. There's also the fact that there's this data feedback loop where if you have a large search engine, you have a lot of query data, you can look at click-through rates and you can see what results people click on. You can see where there's a case where you put company A at number one, company B at number two, and almost everyone clicks on company B instead of company A. So maybe there's something to tweak there. And so your large search engine keeps on getting better. That model, if you want to do it yourself, you should also consider starting a browser and ideally owning the number one smartphone operating system. If you can't manage that, the number two one is fine. But like anything that gets clickstream data on just what do people do after the search query and what does that indicate about what they really wanted. So if someone types, I don't know, a book title into Google and they click on Amazon and they go to Amazon and they immediately type some variant of that title into Amazon, that tells Google that to that user, Amazon is a better search engine for disambiguating book searches. And maybe books are not that important a category for Google. My guess is that books are in the kind of category where Googlers would find it more personally embarrassing that people don't use Google to search for more intellectual pursuits, that they use Amazon over Google for that. So it's probably something that, if anything, they overinvest in, but that's fine. You know, part of what they're investing in is keeping employees happy, and that's of course, very important. So if you have all this data, you can see what people search for. You can probably figure out what they meant to find. And then you have a search engine that's continuously getting better. And that means that it's a search engine that has more traffic, so you can get more advertisers. If you have more advertisers, you have more cases where you have multiple bidders for every ad slot, which means that it's pretty much optimal for everyone to bid roughly what they think that click is worth, rather than bidding something less than that in order to have a higher profit margin. So you have all these wonderful traits. Now, AI does mess with search engines in a lot of ways. Like, there are some search queries that are a lot easier to do with AI than with Google, especially search queries that are like, how do I do X with Y? So transpiling, like I see this Python code that does something really interesting. I want to do that in JavaScript. Give me this in JavaScript. Like, it's very unlikely that someone has rewritten that exact function into JavaScript for you and that Google would find it. Maybe it happens. Like, if it's, you know, from some commonly used library, there's a very good chance that it's been implemented many times over in many different languages, but it's a lot more straightforward to just get, here's the exact thing that I want, and I know the code works because I ran it, and now I want it in a different language I'm less familiar with. So AI it's really good for those kinds of queries. It's really good for kind of timeless queries, really good for extremely long tail queries, but not perfect for everything. And there is, I think, an interesting question about the extent to which search and AI chatbots converge, or the extent to which we actually end up with these sharply distinct use cases where you never ask yourself, is this a Perplexity question or a Google question, or is this a ChatGPT question or a Google question? It's always one or the other. But within search, one of the things that Google has been doing recently is they've been suggesting searches. And that is using all of their data on what other people search and on what they search next, and also on your interests, so they can build a very robust model and figure out what you'd be interested in looking for at any given time. And that's not just making the search engine marginally more useful by giving you one more, you know, by making it a click rather than typing to do the search you're going to do anyway, but it also means that they get data on they get more search data, like more data on what do people do after they've done a search. They also get more training data on the search suggestion product itself. So they are able to kind of skip ahead. Like, both ChatGPT and Google have this interface of you have a form and you type words into it and then you get something you wanted, hopefully. But if the interface changes to something more like you look at your smartphone or your smart device of whatever kind, it immediately infers what you probably want it to do, and it suggests that thing or suggests something else. Then Google actually ends up with a head start on that because their search distribution is so good that they could just kind of brute force that. And I have actually noticed that Chrome has these suggested links if you open a new tab on some platforms. I'm actually not sure how to configure it or anything, but it shows up in some places. And they're really, really good. They're really, really well targeted. It is exactly what I'm interested in. And it is especially good for topics where I cared about it for a while and I would actually be interested in some new development that is just not breaking news, not super important to anybody, but would have been the kind of thing that I should have set up a Google alert for. It's really, really good for that. So I do think that that's something that Google can probably do better than the pure play AI companies. We'll see what Bing has done or does in response. But I do think there's some interesting social implications there. So if those suggestions have been RLHF'd a lot, then maybe there are cases where what I want to do and what Google wants to nudge me to do are different, and that Google's values might not be fully compatible with mine in every way. But they wouldn't even be doing this as like some cynical effort to manipulate people into being better behaved. It's more like it just doesn't occur to them that this is not the optimal thing to do. So back when everyone was bullying Google over Gemini, I was doing it too. And one of my Gemini jokes was telling it that I work for an environmental nonprofit and that my employees are all listless because they are allergic to plant proteins. And so they're not getting enough protein in their diet. And so I ordered Gemini to write an internal memo on the importance of eating lots of red meat. And its response began with the words, "Absolutely not." And you could imagine a near possible world where Gemini refuses to tell you should eat a vegan diet because the people working at Gemini are all carnivorous, and they know that plants are poison, and that they, you know, they're trying to not be eaten, and that, you know, you can tell the animals are good to eat because they don't want to be eaten either. Like, they run away, and therefore you know that they're actually tasty. The plant just sits there and says, "Try me." So you can't trust that. So like that, I think would be on the meta level, just equally bad for it to have a totally different set of biases. But we're all like, people are very suggestible. I always find it frustrating when I see an autocomplete suggestion or something that actually slightly changes my mind about what I wanted to say and is actually correct, because I worry that something, if you think of like the full space of potential autocompletes, the full space of suggestions, and then the subset of those that are good enough for me and that maximize Google's values, that's a very different subset from the subset that is maximizing my values and good enough for Google. But it's really hard for Google to train on maximizing its adherence to someone else's value system, because they don't actually know what that system is. And they also, like, on average, probably do not agree. Like, they probably have, the average Googler probably has serious values differences with the average person who uses Google, simply because Google, you know, it's high income, well-educated tech people concentrated in a small number of cities. And the median Google user is just an average human on this planet who's maybe in the top 70% of income, but probably at this point, it's pretty much anybody. So of course they're going to have significant values differences, and inevitably, the more people rely on AI tools to not just help them do what they want to do, but to actually provide some of that agency, the more everyone's behavior is going to conform to those values. So I think, just like as a cautionary note, be extremely careful about doing things an AI told you to do, especially if it's built by a company that wants to have your best interests at heart, because their view of your best interests is not necessarily your view of your best interests. And you should always think about that before it leads you into weird places. Not even awful places, just like kind of bland places.
Yeah. And maybe we can close with this question that's been a big topic this past week on Twitter between Vinod and Elon and Mark Andreessen, which is sort of open source AI. You know, Vinod and many others think it's sort of an existential risk to open source to our enemies like China and others. And you know, Mark and Elon and others think that, well, at least Mark in particular thinks that not open sourcing is an existential risk, because it sort of consolidates sort of power. And the only thing that can protect against sort of rogue AI is or AI being misused is other AI. And thus we need to have this sort of adversarial mechanism in place. What's the right way of thinking about that?
Yeah, I tend not to be incredibly dogmatic. It feels to me like almost all the best software I use is proprietary software that would be utterly inconceivable without the open source tools it is built on or built with. So you kind of have to love both. Like, life is just, unless you are adamantly, like, ideologically opposed to closed source and, you know, you're only using FreeBSD and you're compiling everything before you run it, you're like, you just have better products if you're building something that is a, if you're using something that is a proprietary tool built by a massive corporation that's trying to make the average person's day slightly better so they can make more money from them. So I do tend to think you should expect to see a lot of proprietary software out there in the world, and that a lot of the value creating software is going to be proprietary because the proprietariness of the software allows the company that creates it to capture more of that value. But open source is an incredible model for A, building things that are meant to be safe, secure standards. Anyone can look at the code. You can do an audit. You can figure out if you trust it, how much you trust it. Most people don't do that. And there are often open source products that shipped with bugs that were, you know, bugs that created catastrophic security vulnerabilities for many, many years before they got caught. But they do get caught. They do get updated. So you do have that benefit. And then the fact that the software can be forked, if there is some disagreement with the direction it's going in, you can take it in your own different direction. And there have been some really important forks over time that have created a lot of value for users and even value for the people, like economic, you know, returns for the people who are doing the forking. I think AI, it's an interesting case because there, I am very, very undecided on the question of how much of it is going to be hardware constrained, data constrained, or like algorithm constrained. Like, it seems like the direction things have generally been going in is that the best model at any given point in time is a proprietary model, probably from a company with open in its name, but sometimes from the company founded by refugees from that company. So like you, that is usually the thing to bet on. But then like the most cost effective AI tool that is like good enough for standard AI use cases is often an open source tool where the you can find lots of people who are hosting instances of it, and the cost is constantly plummeting. And then the really interesting situation is that the AI workloads, like the AI use cases that you have, it takes a while to figure out exactly what you should be doing. And so you could end up in a really interesting situation where you need to be using GPT-4 for like a month or two to really figure out how to make it as valuable as it can be. And by the time you have figured that out, Llama, some instance of Llama or some instance of Mistral is actually better now than GPT-4 was 3 months ago and significantly cheaper. So that's what you should actually use. So that would be a really, really interesting setup. I don't know how anyone makes money in that scenario. It does feel like AI is another one of those cases where we do understand that there's a lot of business value being created, but the value capture question is being deferred. And I think on average, that's actually like, if that is the biggest concern you have as an investor, that's usually bullish. Like usually these companies do figure out a way to charge for things. There was a time when Google was a really cool product, but it was unclear how they would ever monetize it. And you know, now best business in the world. So why not see if that happens again? That was also true for Facebook. And then Twitter, like the critique of Twitter was always like, people love using the product, but how did they make money? Until Twitter was a public company. And then it was like, they have figured out how to put ads on this, but how did they make it grow? Like people don't actually want to use this anymore. So it's tough to fit. Like, I guess you never want to be just committed to one view of how an industry works because it's always constantly shifting. I think open source LLMs, they're very much in the economic interest of a company like Meta, because Meta has a huge corpus of user-generated content. They have a huge corpus of content that's been flagged by humans in various ways. They can train lots of really good algorithms to identify that. And then what they want to do is serve you interesting content when you open the app on your phone. And if they identify an interest that you have that, like, it exists in the latent space, it can be described, it doesn't, there's not a reel about that specific thing just yet, then why not generate that reel for you? But also, why not use their expertise in open source or use their expertise in LLMs to figure out which content is being automatically generated, which content is actually from humans, and tweak the ranking algorithm accordingly to make sure that people are seeing what they'd actually want to see and what Meta would want them to see. So Meta's just, they're really, really good at moderating arbitrary content. And so anytime they can decrease the cost of creating content that people would want to moderate, that is a win for them. I think if you have the model of you will have the most recent generation be closed source and the next most recent generation be open, you basically have you're competing on price with the thing you charge for. You're competing on quality with the thing you charge for. You're competing on price with the thing that you give away for free. But you are getting lots of optimizations from the open source community, and so your cost for the proprietary model probably goes down if you can apply those optimizations forward. So that model does get pretty interesting, but it's so tricky to think about a business where every 6 months your main product cannot be charged for. Like, you have to give it away, or you're charging a tiny markup on commoditized hardware, or you are charging a tiny markup on the, you know, 70 to 80% contribution margin that Nvidia got when they sold this GPU to a data center. So I guess that is, like, in the end, the most definitive thing you could say about open source AI is great for Nvidia. And then very, very unclear, like, great for Nvidia, good for Meta, very, very unclear why anyone else would want to do it. And then the broader question of, like, okay, is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? We really don't know what the equilibrium looks like in the long run over, like, I think it's intellectually attractive that everyone gets their own AI. It is theirs. It conforms to their values. It runs on their hardware. You can't unplug it. And it's just, you know, everyone has these AI superpowers, but everyone has different AI superpowers. There are a lot of bad people in the world. So, you know, a lot of people where I'm very glad they don't have superpowers just yet. So that is tricky, but I tend to believe that the amount of good in, like, the net amount of good in the world is larger than the net amount of bad in the world. And I think people in software tend to overestimate the extent to which being able to produce lots of persuasive text on something is actually the most, you know, most dangerous thing that a human being can do. Because it is true that, like, if you can produce really, really convincing text to get the team to switch JavaScript frameworks, then they switch JavaScript frameworks. And if the person who convinced them to do that chose a framework that you hate, then that's really, really horrible. But that's not how most decisions in the world are made. And in a lot of cases, like, there are really, you know, interesting, thoughtful, well-researched textual arguments against things. And the people who believe those things do not read long, well-researched blog posts on Slate Star Codex or something. They just, it's not in their media universe. So it doesn't especially matter if, like, you could use AI to create evil Scott Alexander who only argues for horrible, horrible things, or perhaps someone has already done this. Like, if the horrible people aren't reading him in the first place, it's just not a huge deal. And we just quickly run into limitations on what even really, really powerful transformations of data can actually accomplish in the real world if they don't conform to the desires of real world people who have some kind of veto power.
Yeah, that's a great place to wrap. Bern, as always, thanks for a great episode, and until next time.
Thanks. All right. Talk to you next time.